All right, hello everyone. I'll give everyone a minute or two to get settled in, but I just wanted to introduce myself and our panelists. So I'm Joe Vukovich. I'm a senior policy analyst at the Northeast Midwest Institute for our Mississippi River Basin program. And we're very happy to have been able to work with Senator Klobuchar's office to put together this briefing for you today. So I'll very briefly introduce our panelists real quick. So first we have Katie Flahive. She's an agricultural engineer with the Non-Point Source Management Branch at the EPA. She works with federal, state, nonprofit, conservation, and industry partners that research, develop, implement, track, and measure the results of voluntary and incentive-based controls to improve water quality in agricultural and rural areas. She works on the EPA hypoxia team, supports the EPA Hypoxia Task Force federal co-chair, and is a federal co-chair of the coordinating committee. Next, we have Matt Lechtenberg. He's the Water Quality Initiative Coordinator for the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Matt manages implementation activities of the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, and he's worked for the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship since 2006. Next, we have Dr. Amanda Gumbert. She serves as the Extension Water Quality Specialist with the University of Kentucky College of Agriculture, Food, and Environment. She's worked on agriculture water quality issues for the past 16 years, with special interest in the Kentucky Agricultural Water Quality Act and streamside buffer zones. And finally, we have Dr. Beth Baker, the Assistant Extension Professor in the College of Forest Resources at Mississippi State University. She's an Extension Specialist for Natural Resource Conservation and Water Quality and leads the Research and Education to Advance Conservation and Habitat Program, or REACH. She has worked in areas of environmental conservation and water quality for over 10 years, with special interest in water quality monitoring, conservation effectiveness, and community engagement. So without any further ado, I'll turn it over to our panelists.
Okay, thanks. All right, thank you so much, Joe, and everyone from Michael from the Northeast Midwest Institute for the invitation to come and talk to you all. I'm Katie Flahive with EPA, and I'll be talking a little bit about kind of the background of the task force, who the task force is, and what we're doing, and then I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues to talk about what the states are actually doing as part of this task force, and what the universities are doing to support the states. I just want to note there are a number of us in the room who work on these issues, so what you're going to be hearing from me say today, people around you are also working on these issues, and it is a very large collaborative effort. When we put everybody in a room together, there's really about 60 people, 70 people sometimes, who are digging in, looking at these issues within the states, the federal agencies, and our partner organizations, and the land grants as well. So a little bit of background on the task force. Who is this task force? We came to be in the late 90s as part of the 1998 Habarca law. And through that law that instituted the fact that the task force would exist, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy coordinated and completed an integrated assessment to really look at the science of the Gulf of Mexico. And that served as the basis for the 2001 action plan of the task force, which indicated our goal to reduce the hypoxic zone to in the northern Gulf of Mexico, kind of at the outlet and to the west of the Birdfoot Delta in the northern Gulf of Mexico, to a size of less than 5,000 square kilometers. And that action plan noted the importance of a reduction in nitrogen, reducing nitrogen loads to the Gulf of Mexico via the Mississippi River. In 2004 to 2007, we realized that science that we were able to learn from in the late 90s was really the tip of the iceberg. There was an incredible amount of research that had been continuing to go on. And considered phosphorus also a co-driver. It's different times of the year that drives that hypoxic zone to form in the northern Gulf of Mexico. So from that science reassessment, we have impaneled a science advisory board panel, which made that recommendation for a dual nutrient strategy. And that formed the basis for the Task Force 2008 Action Plan that included this commitment by states to develop and implement nutrient reduction strategies to reach that target, to reach that goal with the support of the federal agencies. So that's the construct of the task force that you see today. In 2015, we realized that the zone size had not shrunk at that point, and we reaffirmed our target with a 2035 goal for the size of the reduction and put in place an interim target of nutrient reduction by 20% both nitrogen and phosphorus load by 2025. In 2014, the 2014 HBARCA law that was reauthorized then requested and required EPA to submit on behalf of the Hypoxia Task Force to Congress a report to Congress. So that's really the basis for the information that we're going to be sharing with you today. Everything that we talk about is in that report to Congress in a little bit more detail. I encourage you to take a look at it. It's on our website, and it's linked to from this PowerPoint, so you can find that website. So our science-based goal, this is the 2017 zone size that you see. It was actually the largest size on record. And what you see there to the right is the bar chart of the annual size of the zone. So we're looking for a five-year annual average to be reduced to that less than 5,000 square kilometers, which is the dashed line there at the bottom. This is very heavily driven by flow. There's a lot of science that needs to be considered on impacts, and the task force is currently exploring ways that we can best track our progress. So that's what we're really focused on right now. I'm just going to show this. This is one example of a set of data at the basin scale, at the Mississippi basin scale. This is from USGS Sparrow model output. We also look and are informed by the USDA SEEP SWOT model output, as well as other regional and state scale models that are used throughout the basin to tell the story of sources. But what we know from these models is that about 85% of the nitrogen and phosphorus load coming into the Gulf of Mexico is a non-point source. So it just gives us a unique opportunity in this area to work in partnership, to work collaboratively, to identify those tools that are going to get us to our goal that involve as many stakeholders as we can, because that's what it's going to take to look at the reductions that are needed through non-point sources. So the task force members, quickly, we have five federal agencies involved, NOAA, the Army Corps of Engineers, EPA is the federal co-chair, Department of Agriculture, and the U.S. Geologic Survey, and then we also have the National Tribal Water Council represented on the task force, and we have 12 state agencies. Those are the main stem Mississippi River states, as well as Ohio and Indiana. And each state is represented by either on the task force, their member is either the Ag Agency, the Environmental Quality Agency, or the Natural Resources Agency. But then at the level that I work to support the task force, my colleagues on the coordinating committee, we do have multiple states that are represented on that committee by multiple agencies. So we get a broad breadth of the interests in the states and those in the states who are working on these issues across the agencies. So our major priority activities right now, I mentioned briefly that that the states committed to that nutrient reduction strategy. Each state has a nutrient reduction strategy that was developed with the stakeholders in their states through public process that outlines what needs to happen in the state to move the ball. The priority watersheds, each state has identified in their strategy priority watersheds. That's what you see here. So some of the consideration that we have at the federal level is how do we support actions in these priority watersheds, and then how do we support actions to be scaled up beyond those watersheds? And a key piece, so with a 20% nutrient reduction or nitrogen and phosphorus loading reduction goal, how do we track that? How do we know that we are on track to meet that target in 2025? So it's really important to us right now to identify the tools, the models, the data sets that we're going to be using to track that progress from a quantified manner. And we're digging in, you're going to hear a little bit more from Matt about the non-point source measures that the task force is considering right now. We use the national NPDES data set at EPA that the states report to track point source metrics. And of extreme importance to us, and you'll hear from our colleagues from the land-grant universities, is the coordination with the land-grant universities and the research and extension work that they support the states as the states implement their strategy. I can't reiterate it enough. We found that those states, when developing their strategies, when they engaged with those land-grant universities, it really brought a number of stakeholders to the table in addition to the multiple agencies at the state. So we continue to build and leverage those partnerships, and then our report to Congress has been a big priority that was released in early November of last year. From the federal perspective, in 2016, the federal agencies reissued an updated federal strategy in December 2016 that indicates the programs and the support that the federal agencies who are members of the task force provide to the states. Key actions here, improving both MARB and Gulf monitoring data and modeling approaches. Those are the key tools and data sets that we use to track progress in the basin, at the basin scale, and in the Gulf across the zone. Focusing our funding on research on the impacts of those relationships between nutrients and hypoxia, nutrients in the river, nutrients in the Gulf, and how the formation of hypoxia occurs in order to inform those state strategies, those management strategies. From the landscape perspective, targeted delivery of federal funding for conservation systems and watershed planning, both of those are key parts to this, to support those state nutrient reduction strategies that you saw, that list or that map of priority watersheds. And then continuing to develop the tools that the federal agencies have done, improve upon them, those models, expanding research, and of key note is expanding our partnerships. We know that when we leverage those partnerships across organizations that have just key common interests, identifying what those key common interests are and working together on those really makes the funding go a little bit further. And then just in general, having a meeting like we're having this week, tomorrow we're having a public meeting in Arlington, and we'll be talking about what the states are doing, we'll be learning from them and identifying new opportunities that the feds can provide that support. So I noted the tracking progress towards our goal. This is just a variety of the tools and models that we're using. It's multiple scales, multiple time scales, multiple sizes. It goes around from an annual measurement that NOAA supports of the size of the zone to multiple agencies working on decadal basin loading trends through models. This is just another example of a data layer that is key to us and in our tracking progress. This is from USGS. This is at the near where the Atchafalaya and the Mississippi River split in Louisiana, and this is the annual total nitrogen and annual total phosphorus flux at that point in the river. And so we are looking to how we can use this data to ensure that we can quantify our progress, understand where we're headed and the direction we're headed in. And then I've touched on partnerships, but I just can't reiterate it enough. Key to doing this really is building partnerships across the states, across the basin. Farmers and agricultural organizations, leveraging what the states have done through engaging stakeholders as they developed and begin to implement their nutrient reduction strategies. How do we encourage farmer-led actions across the basin? Those are the areas that we know we can if we can provide support to those networks, those will allow us to scale. Working with businesses through organizations like the Midwest Row Crop Collaborative, we're very interested in hearing tomorrow at our public meeting from the Field to Market organization and what they're doing. They are, but they, you know, those organizations are collectively working on the same issues that we are working on. So how can we leverage what's happening? Working with cities and communities, including those municipal treatment plants, identifying opportunities like we're seeing through the USDA RCPP program and other programs that encourage that engagement between farmers and landowners at the watershed scale and those cities and communities. And then just continuing to engage with other conservation organizations such as the Nature Conservancy. They have adopted the same targets that the Hypoxia Task Force has adopted. So how do we leverage actions in the states? And then this is our report to Congress. I encourage you, if you want to dig into some of the data sets that I've mentioned here, you're welcome to be in touch with me. You can also read it a little more about it in the report to Congress. So at this time, thank you. And I'm going to turn it over to Matt Lechtenberg from Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you for the opportunity to present about what's going on in Iowa and our perspectives on our engagement with the Hypoxia Task Force. Wanted to just make a quick comment that if I appreciate that you're recording this, there's a couple of teachers that I'd like to show show that I provided a congressional briefing on. Never would have thought I'd be here talking to you folks, so appreciate the opportunity. And just wanted to provide a couple of unique examples of some of the things that were going on in Iowa and kind of our interaction with the task force. So kind of not close into looking in Iowa and then looking at kind of the task force and trying to provide an example or our perspectives kind of across the states of our the importance of the task force engagement. So Iowa, as Katie mentioned, we were the co-chairs along with the EPA on the Hypoxia Task Force. Talk a little bit about the development of our strategy, our transition implementation, how we're going about it, progress tracking. Getting to get the state perspectives. The Non-Point Source Measures Work Group, which is one of those pieces that Katie had highlighted, go into a little bit more detail on what our role is there. And then on the last part, kind of a new track that we've gone onto with the state members of the task force and weighing in on some of these larger issues that are having an impact in our states as well. So Iowa, we were one of the first states to release our strategy. It was actually in 2012. We had a public comment period for about 6 months after that. So the first and final draft of that strategy was released in 2013. Solely because of the release of the nutrient reduction strategy and the leadership from Secretary Northey and our ag partners, conservation groups in Iowa came together and said we really need dedicated resources to help implement this strategy. It's important to our state. Iowa legislature stepped up and provided a new program called the Water Quality Initiative, which is the program that I work on. And then one of the tasks that we were, one of the main emphasis of that is that we were going to take those state dollars and we were going to turn them into more. And so we've been successful in increasing that funding over based on what the state appropriations are. That program has grown to about $10 million a year. We were able to leverage a portion of that funding. About $8.3 million of that has brought in almost $18 million just from the RCPP program alone, the NRCS RCPP program. We've had private funders. We've got $250,000 from private funders that made contributions to that program in the last year. And then we've got some other projects in the work to stretch those dollars. That's not even including the share that Iowa landowners are putting in to put these practices in as well. Engaging partners, building capacity, overcoming barriers, taking the information that we know and using that to inform and prioritize practices, and then understanding that the reason that a lot of these practices haven't been installed is because there's been some barriers or some limitations, and so how do we overcome those and work with folks to address those. And then we have the report to Congress that Katie had mentioned, but we also have our Iowa report that we come out annually with. That was just released here the last couple of months, and the link is there. You can read the report on Iowa-specific activities. What we do in Iowa is we follow a logic model approach. So what our ultimate goal is going to be impacting the water. And we measure water. We're one of the leading states in the nation with real-time nitrate sensors. I believe about a third of all the sensors in Iowa are in the nation are deployed in Iowa. So we're doing a lot of water measuring, but we also need to know what's going on in the land. To influence what's going on in the water, we need to know what's going on in the land. Before we know there's changes in the land, we need to have human behavior change, and then we also need to measure our inputs. So rather than just looking at one of those independently, we need to look at them all together. And some exciting news today is that the Iowa legislature actually just passed another funding bill, nearly $300 million over the next 12 years, actually being signed by the governor today to ensure our commitment to the nutrient reduction strategy. Again, we're going to continue those themes of leveraging and engaging partners. All of this is because of the Iowa nutrient reduction strategy. Leadership from the states, here stepping back from Iowa and just looking about our interaction with all our my colleagues in other states. All of our states have nutrient reduction strategies. They're all unique, but there are a lot of similarities. So you can see that impact or that interaction that we have shows up in our strategy. So if Indiana did something that we think is really great, then we start to look for ways that we can incorporate that into how we administer our programs or the things that we can do for measuring or reaching out to partners. It provides a great opportunity for states because we have a direct interaction with our federal partners. We work across borders. We have, again, RCPPs and other funding. We work across borders, have multi-state programs where we can have that interaction and not just be in our own silo in our own state. And then also improved coordination and collaboration with our land grants. Having the science behind the activities that we're doing has been critical. Many states have incorporated the land grants into their development of their strategies for the science-based assessments of what are the practices that are needed to achieve the reductions that we're after here. And then we're also working together on addressing common measures, tracking progress, but then also recognizing the individuality of our individual states. So non-point source measures work group is a group that all states are participating in. Katie mentioned the coordinating committee. Those members are the ones that are working on developing that common measure for our non-point source measures. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that we also have a point source measures group as well. So we're working together, point source and non-point source, to tracking these components with multiple states working on all those as well. So the task force led the charge and saying what's a common measure that we can do for non-point source measures. If you think about all the things that we could be measuring, we can measure water, we can measure social impacts, we can measure land use, all of those things. What is the one thing that we can focus on and that's going to be as impactful as possible? So the measures work group took that task and that guidance and said what's going to be the most impactful and what's something that all the states can reasonably report on. Again, it's not the only measure. And then also the importance of this is to show progress, but that's not our only that's not the only thing that we want to do with this. We want this to inform progress. So if we see the things that we're measuring are not going the way that we need to, what do we need to do to address those? What are those barriers? What are those gaps? How can we come together to speed up the process and scale up that process and address those critical gaps? So while it sounds pretty easy, to just say we're going to measure one thing, and the non-point source measures, there's a lot of challenges that are within that. So we have a final draft report that will be presented to the task force today for the hypoxia test, or tomorrow actually, I believe, and get hypoxia task force members' input on. And it really details all the work that we've done prior to this, the starting of the group to where we're at today. So we settled on practice summary. So what's that holistic look at what are the practices that are being implemented on the land? Thinking that in order to have influence on the water, we need to know what's going on in the land. There's a critical missing gap in knowing comprehensively what's going on across the basin as far as practices. When we see things happen with the size of the Gulf, even with if it's larger than it should be or if it's smaller than it should be, you hear both sides say, well, we're doing a great job if it's smaller because the size of the zone is smaller. Then next year it turns around and it's larger than it should be, and it's like, oh, farmers are doing the wrong things, they're putting on too much fertilizer, it's not working. And that can happen in the span of 2 or 3 years. So it's quite a difference. And so what we want to do is that we want to measure the water. We want to measure all the things that Katie talked about, but we also want to look at and address that critical gap of what's going on in the landscape so we can have an informed decision on what it is that we need to do to influence the nutrients, and then we also have informing that progress as well. So we broke down the categorization of that practice summary between the various sources, so state and local level, federal level, and then private NGO. We've come a long ways in getting the federal data, thanks to our partners at NRCS, and providing a lot of that information. That's really helped advance the conversation. Early on, it was like, well, we can't get this data, so we don't know what it looks like, so we're not going to measure what we're measuring, or it's not going to be good enough, or whatever. But having something concrete to look at, then that helped the other states say, oh, wait, this is great, but we need this. Or having that conversation, and then states can start to say, well, we have our data in that same way, too. So we developed, from those discussions, a non-point source framework that we think that states can report to. We have an interesting opportunity with the Walton Family Foundation grant to look at that and look at some pilot states of looking at integrating those types of that type of information, and then I mentioned the report. This graph just shows a highlight of the difficulty in reporting, because we have such strong partnerships with all of these sources. This is the alphabet soup that everybody knows happens in government. So I won't go through all those explanations, but these are programs, and they all have common interaction between all of those sources. So making sure that we're not duplicating efforts and double measuring, all of those challenges that are out there. And then I just make a note of private data. When we put the framework together, we used federal state data sets to inform what that framework looked like, but we also wanted to have a framework that was reportable for outside groups, because we know that there's a lot of, through our work at Task Force, of folks that want to be engaged, want to be a part of this. Is it something that they can be all inclusive and report to them? We recognize that because of the sources of those funding sources, that we're not going to get the resolution that we maybe have, but still important information to inform our work here. And then there's also some other higher level information that we're not going to have the resolution again, but it's important to address those critical links. And we especially start talking about infield nutrient management. We've been doing some remote sensing, looking at structural practice adoption over time as well. That's one of those critical gaps of addressing what's going on in the landscape. And then the last thing I just want to mention is that we recently, as state members, the state members got together and said it's important that we provide some feedback and some recommendations on the drafting of the Farm Bill, what's important to the task force members. And so there's three common themes there. Encourage greater emphasis on funding and practices limit nutrient losses. So a lot of our programs are trying to address a whole breadth of resource concerns. And all of those have a disproportionate effect on nutrients. So if it's habitat, if it's water quantity, if it's energy, all of those things, the task force just weighed in. So just to, our 2 cents to greater emphasis on those practices that have an effect on nutrients, as you would expect, since that's our priority. So not to discount the importance of all those other aspects, though. Encourage and expand the engagement from partners to prioritize and implement programs. Programs that we administer are administered primarily by state folks or federal folks, but we also have private sector folks that want to be engaged and be a part of this. We need to allow for that investment. We need to allow for them to be a part of these types of initiatives. And then again, to our SARA 46 partnership, we need to prioritize and expand our investments in on-farm research and monitoring. We certainly don't know everything that we need to know about nutrient loss and what's happening in the hypoxic zone. And so having that research side is critical to advancing our efforts. Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Matt. Again, I'm Amanda Gumber with the University of Kentucky. Excuse me. I'm not sure I'm quite tall enough for that mic. So I'm going to talk a little bit about SARA 46 and what the land grant institutions are bringing to the partnership. Let's see. Oops, wrong way. Let's go this way. That'll be better. So just to start out, just a brief background of what our land grant institutions do. We hear that term sometimes, but again, with the alphabet soup, we'll explain that a bit. And so the land grant institutions really have a three-pronged approach. mechanism that we operate under, and that's first teaching and research and finally extension. And so I'm 100% extension appointed, so that means that it's my job to take the information that we have at the University of Kentucky out to the people of the state so that they can use it and improve their lives to the best possible extent. And so that's what the basis of all of our Sarah 46 universities is. And so just to describe to you what Sarah is, it is Sarah stands for Southern Extension and Research Activity Committee Number 46, which doesn't mean a thing to you all, except that it is an extension research partnership. We happen to be administratively housed in the southern region, but we also incorporate universities in the north central region as well. We're just housed in the southern region. And so USDA NIFA actually coordinates these multi-state projects. And so the Sarah 46 group was brought together to form this really strong coordination and linkage with the hypoxia task force. And so that's the goal. Those are the highlighted states. The yellow stars are the locations of our institutions that are part of Sarah 46. And so really our overall goal as a committee is to promote effective implementation of science-based approaches to nutrient management and conservation that reduce nutrient losses to the environment. And I really want to emphasize that science-based approach. That is truly what the land grants are built upon, is our research component. And among our team members, there's roughly two members per state. And so we are soil scientists, engineers, ecologists, economists, social scientists. So you can imagine the exciting conversation and the level of nerddom that happens within our meetings. But Beth and I were just talking this morning and how excited we all are as representatives from our institutions just to get together with our colleagues and exchange ideas. And so we do that on a regular basis and also in parallel to the work the task force does. So we've been pretty excited to be part of this effort. So what we bring is multiple institutions that are focusing on regional issues and bringing about some regional solutions. We are multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary, and we just bring all of our analytical and different thinking minds together to help work on this very large problem. But at the basis, again, of all of it is the integration of research and extension. It's taking, it's maybe finding new information, it's establishing those research principles and applying that in the field, and then also extending it out to the end user. So the Sarah 46, in collaboration with the task force, adopted a set of priorities for collaboration. This is a document that we first adopted in May of 2015. We recently went through a revision in September of this past year. And the three focus areas of the document are strengthening networks, conservation systems research and outreach, and then finally tracking and monitoring progress. And I think that's been a pretty common theme for all of us. We're trying to strengthen our networks among our own institutions, even within our own individual institutions, but then also across the basin, and then those networks also with our colleagues. And certainly, how do we track progress that we've been making? So some of the things that we have done, just to show you some of our progress in the last couple of years, Matt talked about looking at the state nutrient reduction strategies on a state level, and looking at the similarities and differences among those reduction strategies. Oh, thank you, Matt. Thanks. And so look at, you know, what are the common attributes, what are the gaps? And then another part of that conservation systems research and outreach is also looking at how we optimize cover crop practice performance. And I know Beth has a project that is going on now. And then also we have some cross-basin collaboration on cover crops. And also part of what we do is maybe it's not our expertise that's at the table, maybe it's our colleagues, maybe there's some other multi-state groups that we can rely on and look to them for that information. And then also applying, translating the science into accessible information. That again is really the principle for extension. We have to take sometimes high-level scientific information and boil it down for the end user. What does that end user need to know? And so one example is a document that has come out of our work is the 10 ways to reduce nitrogen loads from drained cropland in the Midwest. So that's a very practical approach for farmers to use on what practices are best for them to reduce their nitrogen loads. Another project that we are making great headway on is creating a network of watershed practitioners and farmer leaders. And so this particular project is bringing together farmers, university folks like myself, farm advisors, government agencies, watershed project coordinators, and bringing them together to brainstorm how we can have more positive effect in our watersheds in terms of leadership. Do we need to identify more farmer-led projects? And how do we equip them with the information they need? So we are all convening in Memphis in about 3 weeks, and that will be our first event where we will exchange ideas and figure out how we move forward on a watershed level. And then the last thing I want to talk about before I'll hand it over to Beth is looking at some social indicators. We have another working group who I think this just really exemplifies how we as university folks work, is that we have a small working group of our SARA 46 representatives, and they have worked together with their network of colleagues, and they've put together a group that's really looking at social indicators. And really just what this means is, why do people make the decisions they make? What are the drivers that are leading to the decisions they're making on the ground? And how do we use social science, research, and information to tweak that just a bit or to optimize those decisions so that we can reduce the nutrient loads that we lose to the environment? So I'll let Beth take over from here and talk about some of our other collaborations and future work.
All right, so in addition to that progress that Amanda spoke about, we've come a long way in developing and maintaining very valuable collaborations as a unit. And so many of the representatives of SARA 46 as research and extension professors work on the ground with farmers. So we're doing on-farm research, we're doing on-farm demonstrations, and related to that, on-farm conservation and water quality monitoring. So we're out there with producers, as well as some representatives do have strong working relationships with their state departments of agriculture. As an example, Iowa State University is looked at as a resource in terms of science, research, and technology related to water quality, nutrient management, and on-farm conservation for their state department of agriculture. And I know many of the other representatives of SARA 46 would look to develop and serve as in that role within the other states. We've also developed valuable collaborations, of course, with the state and federal agencies that are represented by the Hypoxia Task Force and other multi-state committees, as Amanda mentioned, that have expertise in other areas that serve the goals and priorities of the Hypoxia Task Force. And so much of the progress we've made in SARA 46 will continue under specific shared priorities, specifically the monitoring and tracking of progress, which is an ongoing priority area, especially related to non-point source nutrient reduction framework and developing that measurement framework throughout the basin. And so, again, that's continual work that needs to be done in monitoring how we are doing in terms of progress. And also within our strengthening networks focus area, work will be continued in facilitating dialogue between our SARA 46 members and those state agencies, as well as communicating within the SARA 46 group, science and research that's going on throughout the basin, so that we can directly translate that to our Hypoxia Task Force state members, where it can be translated into our into their nutrient reduction strategies within the states as an adaptive management strategy. And as we accomplish certain priorities, we develop and propose new priorities that can move the Hypoxia Task Force work along. And so two of these future efforts that we aim to tackle and have begun working on, the first one is to expand the economic shared priority with the Hypoxia Task Force, specifically around developing on-farm economic tools, as well as developing materials that quantify the costs and benefits of on-farm conservation and in terms of economics. And so this work has begun. Amanda mentioned a cover crop project we have, which includes not just the environmental benefits of that conservation practice, but also the economic benefits and agronomic benefits. So taking a more holistic approach in some of these research projects. So that work has begun, and the work with the committee has yet to be funded. In addition to that, we've developed another shared priority that we have proposed to the task force, which includes expanding research and extension on multifunctional agricultural landscapes, which provide a broad suite of these societal ecosystem services. And so when we use the term multifunctional landscapes, the picture there's a pollinator in it, you probably can't find it, but there's a pollinator in it. But multifunctional landscapes just refer to more conservation in working land so that it serves not only the farmers and their farm sustainability in terms of having adequate soil resources, water resources, providing wildlife habitat, but also them providing those societal environmental benefits as well as gaining agronomic benefits in terms of maintaining yields and production. And so again, we've identified a working group within the SARA 46 committee, and that work has also yet to be funded. And so for the work that we've been doing in the past and our current work, the representatives of SARA 46 as research and extension professors at these land-grant universities inherently leverage USDA NIFA funds and the state matching funds in our time and effort, just in our salaries. And we've also been active in seeking out external opportunities and capitalizing on those to secure external funding from the US EPA in terms of competitive funds, and also the Walton Family Foundation. And so we are happy to go out and secure funds like that, and we look for opportunities like that. And so if there's anything that Congress can do to support water-related programs that support the progress and priorities of the Hypoxia Task Force, that would be very fundamental to our progress and continued work. And if you'd like more information on the work that SARA 46 does, it can be found at the North Central Water website or within the Hypoxia Task Force partnership page on the EPA website. And on behalf of SARA 46, we would like to thank you for affording us this opportunity to be here today and to share our work with you.
So we have a little under 15 minutes for questions, so if anybody has a question, then by all means.
Any progress on green film work?
Somebody else could probably answer that better than I could. I haven't heard anything.
Matt, maybe you can talk a little bit more about the recent funding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so still pretty new. I'll be signed and start this next fiscal year. It's going to be two main breakdowns of it. Is one is going to be more like our traditional type cost share demonstration project type mechanism, and the other part is through a revolving loan state SRF type program. And a portion of it would go to supplement our current state SRF. And then it would also create a new state-only SRF program. And then there's also some urban conservation. So all of that funding can work together, work cooperatively. But then since it is kind of the loan program, part of the emphasis is building non-point source relationships, having cities that need to do upgrades to their wastewater facilities, and then ones that also integrate other nutrient reduction practices and investments in the watershed, and things are going to be prioritized. Coming together, have watershed-type approaches is going to be the emphasis of those. Bringing in those links of having that mechanism to create that the ability to finance, I guess, from those dollars, leveraging all of the sources that are out there. A lot to be seen yet on exactly what that is, but we've got more flexibility and more options to do some unique projects in Iowa with that bill. And it's what's the really attractive part for us, and I was talking to Rebecca on the way over here about it, is when we have opportunities like RCPP and other things, we're held to the state appropriations that we have of that year. And so we need to leverage our dollars, and we have more. We have the leveraging power that we have with the dollars we have in hand. But if we know that those appropriations are going to come, which this bill does, for the next 12 years, that gives us more ability to bring in more outside resources, because we know we can bank on those dollars coming in for the next 5 years or whatever that time frame is. And so that's the other really advantageous part of this new funding for us.
Very innovative to create the revolving programs. Are you also looking at loan guarantees and other things that you might use to further those?
I don't know all the details on what the revolving loan stuff is going to be administered through the Iowa Finance Authority. So it's kind of out of my expertise and what they're looking at. So.
As a farm bill year, do you guys have any opinions or thoughts on ways to tweak some of the conservation programs so that greater support can go to the practices that I think we've all discussed currently, given that I'm not going to be seeing any new money in the title, how to squeeze some of the benefits out of the program?
Is that for me? I guess the letter kind of goes into a few things. I mean, we'd obviously prioritize nutrients. There's probably some practices, I guess, just from Iowa's perspective, when we look at the information that we have and all the funding and where the practices and what they're being installed with those funding sources, and being able to do some additional practices or maybe some different practices. What kind of Iowa's perspective and what my perspective is that some of those practices need partnership with outside sources rather than the traditional model of depending on farmer or landowner investment, because these practices don't have a return for their individual bottom line. So that's where state funding or outside funding can really come in and close those critical gaps. Saying that, we're working on this in Iowa on a small scale, where we need to be able to just do this automatically, but we're working through some channels because this is new. That we just need to understand how it's going to work type thing. The way we do things is different than what NRCS or EPA does, and so we need to kind of navigate that process, and hopefully there's some opportunities that we can streamline, but it's going to be it's going to be one of the situations where we got to go through it and figure out some of those things before and we can just start running with it. So.
Katie, the 20% reduction target, is that from the original time or when the target was designed? And is there a relationship between the size of the hypoxia and the concentration?
Two good questions. The first question, the target, the 20% nutrient or nitrogen and phosphorus load reduction target is based on a 1980 to 1996 baseline. So one of the slides that I had up there indicated the annual flux, total nitrogen and phosphorus flux, and that did show a dark solid line of the baseline that we consider to be what we're moving towards our goal from. Your second question, sorry, can you?
The size of the hypoxia.
Size and the relationship. NOAA has consistently provided support to a broad group of researchers in this area, and there's been a lot of new research on this in the very recent past. There's a couple of papers that have come out this year that inform us on the linkages between concentrations in the river, how it moves into the Gulf, how that forms the zone, how we look at it from an aerial extent. NOAA has now supported models that look at it from a 3D perspective. We don't quite know how we're going to integrate that information into our work, but we're really excited to dig into some of that new science that's come out, learn from it, and figure out how we can integrate that. But there are linkages mainly through a variety of models. There's one thing I didn't say, for any type of tracking progress, and you heard me mention Sparrow and SWOT, there can be no one model. We've got to find a way to integrate all the different varieties of tools that are used by states, by organizations, by the federal government into this. So there's a variety of models that support our understanding of what's happening in the Gulf, how the zone reacts to the concentrations that are delivered through the river.
My understanding is it's load, not concentration, that's the driver. Is that incorrect?
I'm probably not the best one in this room to answer that question, but we look at it from a loading perspective. Each year, like Matt said, you have different annual rainfall that drives the load. So it's important to understand both concentrations and loads, but we look at the models in the Gulf talk to us, or explain the formation of the zone from a load perspective.
Any other questions? All right, well, thank you everyone for coming out here, and thank you again to panelists and Senator Klobuchar's office for making this possible. So thanks to everyone.